is external, but if you want to write a novel that sells, you have to have conflict. We understand conflict because we experience conflict, right? But where does conflict come from? Why do we experience conflict in our lives? This helped me a great deal in accepting the idea of original sin and the birth of conflict. The rebellion against God explained why humans experienced conflict in their lives, and nobody knows of any explanation other than this. This last point was crucial. I felt like I was having an epiphany. Without the Christian explanation of original sin, the seemingly silly story about Adam and Eve and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, there was no explanation of conflict. At all. Now, some people process the account of original sin in the book of Genesis as metaphor, as symbolism for something else that happened. But whether you take it metaphorically or literally, this serves as an adequate explanation of the human struggle that every person experiences. Loneliness. Crying yourself to sleep at night. Addiction. Pride. War. And self-addiction. The heart responds to conflict within story, I began to think, because there is some great conflict in the universe with which we are interacting, even if it is only in the subconscious. If we were not experiencing some sort of conflict in our lives, our hearts would have no response to conflict in books or film. The idea of conflict, of having tension, suspense, or an enemy would make no sense to us. But these things do make sense. We understand these elements because we experience them. As much as I did not want to admit it, Christian spirituality explained why. And then the element of story known as climax. Every good story has a climax. Climax is where a point of decision determines the end of the story. Now, this was starting to scare me a little bit. If the human heart uses the tools of reality to create elements of story, and the human heart responds to climax in the structure of story, this means that climax, or point of decision, could very well be something that exists in the universe. What I mean is that there is a decision the human heart needs to make. The elements of story began to parallel my understanding of Christian spirituality. Christianity offered a decision, a climax. It also offered a good and a bad resolution. In part, our decisions were instrumental to the way our story turned out. Now, this was spooky because for thousands of years, big-haired preachers have talked about the idea that we need to make a decision, to follow or reject Christ. They would offer these ideas as a sort of magical solution to the dilemma of life. I had always hated hearing about it because it seemed so entirely unfashionable a thing to believe, but it did explain things. Maybe these unfashionable ideas were pointing at something mystical and true. And perhaps I was judging the idea not by its merit, but by the fashionable or unfashionable delivery of the message. A long time ago, I went to a concert with my friend Rebecca. Rebecca can sing better than anybody I've ever heard sing. I heard this folk singer was coming to town, and I thought she might like to see him because she was a singer too. The tickets were $20, which is a lot to pay if you're not on a date. Between songs, though, he told a story that helped me resolve some things about God. The story was about his friend who is a Navy SEAL. He told it like it was true. So I guess it was true, although it could have been a lie. The folk singer said his friend was performing a covert operation, freeing hostages from a building in some dark part of the world. His friend's team flew in by helicopter, made their way to the compound, and stormed into the room where the hostages had been imprisoned for months. The room, the folk singer said, was filthy and dark. The hostages were curled up in a corner, terrified. When the SEALs entered the room, they heard the gasps of the hostages. They stood at the door and called to the prisoners, telling them they were Americans. The SEALs asked the hostages to follow them, but the hostages wouldn't. They sat there on the floor and hid their eyes in fear. They were not of healthy mind and didn't believe their rescuers were really Americans. The SEALs stood there not knowing what to do. They couldn't possibly carry everybody out. One of the SEALs, the folk singer's friend, got an idea. He put down his weapon, took off his helmet, and curled up tightly next to the other hostages, getting so close his body was touching some of theirs. He softened the look on his face and put his arms around them. He was trying to show them he was one of them. None of the prison guards would have done this. He stayed there for a little while until some of the hostages started to look at him, finally meeting his eyes. The Navy SEAL whispered that they were Americans and were there to rescue them. "Will you follow us?" he said. The hero stood to his feet and one of the hostages did the same, then another, until all of them were willing to go. The story ends with all the hostages safe on an American aircraft carrier. I never liked it when the preachers said we had to follow Jesus. Sometimes they would make him sound angry. But I liked the story the folk singer told. I liked the idea of Jesus becoming man so that we would be able to trust him. And I liked that he healed people and loved them and cared deeply about how people were feeling. When I understood that the decision to follow Jesus was very much like the decision the hostages had to make to follow their rescuer, I knew then that I needed to decide whether or not I would follow him. The decision was simple once I asked myself, is Jesus the Son of God? Are we being held captive in a world run by Satan, a world filled with brokenness, and do I believe Jesus can rescue me from this condition? If life had a climax, which it must in order for the element of climax to be mirrored in story, then Christian spirituality was offering a climax. It was offering a decision. The last element of story is resolution. Christian spirituality offered a resolution, the resolution of forgiveness and a home in the afterlife. Again, it all sounded so very witless to me, but by this time I wanted desperately to believe it. It felt as though my soul were designed to live the story Christian spirituality was telling. I felt like my soul wanted to be forgiven. I wanted the resolution God was offering. And there it was. Setting, conflict, climax, and resolution. As silly as it seemed, it met the requirements of the heart and it matched the facts of reality. It felt more than true. It felt meaningful. I was starting to believe I was a character in a greater story, which is why the elements of story made sense in the first place. The magical proposition of the gospel, once free from the clasps of fairy tale, was very adult to me, very gritty like something from Hemingway or Steinbeck, like something with copious amounts of sex and blood. Christian spirituality was not a children's story. It wasn't cute or neat. It was mystical and odd and clean, and it was reaching into dirty. There was wonder in it. And enchantment. Perhaps, I thought, Christian spirituality really was the difference between illusion and magic. Chapter 4. Shifts. Find a penny. Some of the Christians in Portland talk about Reed College as if it is Hades. They say the students at Reed are pagans, heathens in heart. Reed was recently selected by the Princeton Review as the college where students are most likely to ignore God. It is true. It is a godless place, known for existential experimentation of all sorts. There are no rules at Reed, and many of the students there have issues with authority. Reed's students, however, are also brilliant. Lauren Pope, former education editor for the New York Times, calls Reed the most intellectual college in the country. Reed receives more awards and fellowships per capita than any other American college and has entertained more than 30 Rhodes Scholars. For a time, my friend Ross and I got together once each week to talk about life and the Old Testament. Ross used to teach Old Testament at a local seminary. Sometimes Ross would talk about his son Michael, who was a student at Reed. During the year Ross and I were getting together to talk about the Old Testament, I had heard Michael was not doing well. Ross told me Michael had gotten his girlfriend pregnant and the girl was not allowing him to see the child. His son was pretty heartbroken about it. During his senior year at Reed, Ross's son died by suicide. He jumped from a cliff on the Oregon coast. After it happened, Ross was in terrible pain. The next time I got together with him, about a month after the tragedy, Ross sat across from me with blue cheeks and moist eyes. It was as if everything sorrowful in the world was pressing on his chest. To this day, I cannot imagine any greater pain than losing a child. I never knew Michael, but everybody who did loved him. The students at Reed flooded his email box with goodbye letters and notes of disbelief. Through the years after Michael's death, even after Ross and I stopped meeting because I moved across town, Reed remained in the back of my mind. Not too many years went by before I started thinking about going back to school. I wasn't sure what to study, but I heard Reed had a terrific humanities program. I am a terrible student. I always have been. Deadlines and tests do me in. I can't take the pressure. Tony the Beat Poet, however, told me he was considering auditing a humanities class at Reed, ancient Greek literature. He asked me if I wanted to join him. At the time, I was attending this large church in the suburbs. It was like going to church at the Gap. I don't know why I went there. I didn't fit. I had a few friends, though, very nice people, and when I told them I wanted to audit classes at Reed, they looked at me as if I wanted to date Satan. One friend sat me down and told me all about the place, how they have a 3-day festival at the end of the year in which they run around naked. She said some of the students probably use drugs. She told me God did not want me to attend Reed College. The first day of school was exhilarating. It was better than high school. Reed had ashtrays, and everybody said cuss words. There were 400 freshmen in my humanities class. Dr. Peter Steinberger, the acting president, delivered a lecture of which I understood about 10%. But the 10% I understood was brilliant. I loved it. I made noises while he was teaching, humming noises, noises in agreement with his passionate decrees. After class, I would usually go to Commons to get coffee and organize my notes. It was in Commons where I met Laura, who, although she was an atheist, would teach me a great deal about God. Her father, whom she loved and admired dearly, was a Methodist minister in Atlanta, and yet she was the only one in her family who could not embrace the idea of God. She explained that her family loved her all the same, that there was no tension because of her resistance to faith. Laura and I started meeting every day after lecture, rehashing the day's themes. I don't believe I had ever met anybody as brilliant as Laura. She seemed to drink in the complicated themes of Greek literature as though they were cartoons. "What did you think of the lecture?" I once asked her. "I thought it was okay." "Just okay?" I asked. "Yeah, I mean, this is supposed to be a pretty challenging school, and I wasn't that challenged. Not that good of an introduction, if you ask me. I hope they don't put the cookies on a lower shelf all year." "Cookies?" I asked. I thought she had cookies. Laura would go on to explain the ideas I didn't understand. In time, she figured out that I was a Christian, but we didn't talk much about it. We normally discussed literature or the day's lecture, but one day Laura brought up an odd topic: racism in the history of the church. She had moved to Portland from Georgia where, though she is an atheist, she told me she witnessed, within a church, the sort of racial discrimination most of us thought ended 50 years ago. She asked me very seriously what I thought about the problem of racism in America and whether the church had been a harbor for that sort of hatred. It had been a long time since I'd thought about it, to be honest. Just out of high school, I got hooked on Martin Luther King and read most of his books, but since then the issue had faded in my mind. I am sure there are exceptions, but for the most part, I think evangelical churches failed pretty badly during the civil rights movement, as did nearly every other social institution. Laura looked down into her coffee and didn't say anything. I knew from previous conversations she had dated a black student back in Atlanta who was now at Morehouse College, where Dr. King himself earned a degree. Her question was not philosophical. It was personal. I told her how frustrating it is to be a Christian in America, and how frustrated I am with not only the church's failures concerning human rights, but also my personal failure to contribute to the solution. I wondered out loud, though, if there was a bigger issue, and I mistakenly made the callous comment that racism might be a minor problem compared to bigger trouble we have to deal with. Racism? Not an issue? She questioned very sternly. Well, not that it's not an issue, only that it is a minor issue. How can you say that? She sat back restlessly in her chair. Don, it is an enormous problem. I was doing a lot of backpedaling at first, but then I began to explain what I meant. Yeah, I understand it is a terrible and painful problem, but in light of the whole picture, racism is a signal of something greater. There is a larger problem here than tension between ethnic groups. Unpack that statement, Laura said. I'm talking about self-absorption. If you think about it, the human race is pretty self-absorbed. Racism might be the symptom of a greater disease. What I mean is, as a human, I am flawed in that it is difficult for me to consider others before myself. It feels like I have to fight against this force, this current within me that more often than not wants to avoid serious issues and please myself, buy things for myself, feed myself, entertain myself, and all of that. All I'm saying is that if we as a species could fix our self-absorption, we could end a lot of pain in the world. Laura didn't say much more that afternoon, but we got together several weeks later and she hinted she agreed about this problem of self-absorption. She called it sin. Wait, I began. How can you believe in sin but not in God? I just do, she said. But you can't. I can do what I want. She looked at me sternly. Okay, I said, knowing that if we got into an argument, she would win. Laura and I didn't talk much about religion after that. She had dreams of becoming a writer, so we talked about literature. She would give me articles or essays she had written. I ate them. They were terrific. It was very much an honor to even know her. I could sense very deeply that God wanted a relationship with Laura. Ultimately, I believe that God loves and wants a relationship with every human being, but with Laura, I could feel God's urgency. Laura, however, wanted little to do with it. She never brought up the idea of God, so I didn't either. I felt alive at Reed. Reed is one of the few places on earth where a person can do just about anything they want. On one of my first visits to campus, the American flag had been taken down and replaced with a flag bearing the symbol for anarchy. As odd as it sounds, having grown up in the church, I fell in love with the campus. The students were brilliant and engaged. I was fed there, stimulated and impassioned. I felt connected to the raging current of thoughts and ideas. And what's more, I had more significant spiritual experiences at Reed College than I ever had at church. One of the things I cherished about Reed was that any time I stepped on campus, I would find a conversation going about issues that mattered to me. Reed students love to dialogue. There are always groups of students discussing global concerns, exchanging ideas and views that might solve some of the world's problems. I was challenged by the students at Reed because they were on the front lines of so many battles for human rights. Some of them were fighting just to fight, but most of them weren't. Most of them cared deeply about peace. Interacting with these guys showed me how shallow and self-centered my Christian faith had become. Many of the students hated the very idea of God, and yet they cared about people more than I did. There were only a few students on campus who claimed to be Christians. Though I was only auditing classes, I was accepted into this small group. We would meet in the chapel to pray each week or hold Bible studies in one of the dorm rooms. It was very underground, secret. There has always been a resistance to Christianity on the campus at Reed. The previous year, a few Christians made a small meditation room on campus on Easter Sunday. They simply turned down the lights in a room in the library, lit some candles, and let students know the room was there if anybody wanted to pray. When Easter morning rolled around, students decided to protest. They purchased a keg of beer, got drunk, and slaughtered a stuffed lamb inside the meditation room. The perspective the students in our group had about the event was Christ-like. They were hurt, somewhat offended, but mostly broken-hearted. The event was tough on our group. We did not feel welcome on campus. But I learned so much from the Christians at Reed. I learned that true love turns the other cheek, does not take a wrong into account, loves all people regardless of their indifference or hostility. The Christians at Reed seemed to me, well, revolutionary. I realize Christian beliefs are ancient, but I had never seen them applied so directly. The few Christians I met at Reed showed me that Christian spirituality was a reliable faith, both to the intellect and the spirit. I knew that Laura would fit in with this group. I knew that Laura, no matter how far she was from God, could come to know him. The story of how my friend Penny came to know God gave me hope for Laura. I was first introduced to Penny at a party on the front lawn, but I thought she was too good-looking to talk to, so I sort of slid off into the crowd. Later, she showed up at a prayer meeting we had in my friend Ivan's room, and I got to know her pretty well. We discovered that we were both ridiculously insecure, and so we became friends. Penny is living proof that Jesus still pursues people. Even Reedies. Penny had a crazy experience with God while she was studying in France. She gives all the credit to Nadine, another of the very few Christians at Reed, and a member of our little rebel religious outfit. When Penny and Nadine first met, Penny wasn't a Christian. They had both spent their freshman years at Reed, but never knew each other. Individually, they decided to study at the same school in France during their sophomore year. Penny wanted nothing to do with religion. Her perception of Christians was that they were narrow-minded people, politically conservative and hypocritical. Penny disliked Christians because it seemed on every humanitarian issue she found herself directly opposing the opinions held by many evangelicals. She also felt that if Christianity were a person, that is, all Christians lumped into one human being, that human being probably wouldn't like her. After arriving in France, Penny was scheduled to spend a few weeks in Paris on vacation before heading north to Sarah Lawrence College in Rennes. When she arrived, she contacted some of the girls she would be studying with. One of these girls happened to be Nadine. You have to know that Penny and Nadine are very different, opposites, in fact. It is amazing that they hit it off at all. Not only did they have completely different religious ideas, but they also came from starkly contrasting backgrounds. Nadine, for instance, descended from Scottish royalty, still having a copious amount of pomp in her bloodline. Penny was born in a green army tent on a hippie commune in the Pacific Northwest. I should paint the background for you a little bit so you can understand why I find it so interesting these girls became friends. Nadine's grandmother was born into the Stuart clan, a royal family in Scotland. Her grandmother married and moved to the Congo, where the family was stationed as diplomats for the Belgian government. Nadine's mother was raised with a slew of servants, including a driver, a cook, a butler, and a nanny. She was never allowed to speak to her parents unless spoken to first. Nadine's mother ran her home in similar fashion, passing down many of the traditions of aristocracy. When Nadine and Penny met in France, it was as if they were exchanging notes from different planets. No less interesting than Nadine's story is Penny's, whose parents originally named her Plenty. She changed her name shortly after she realized she could. At the hippie commune where Penny was born, her parents experimented with drugs in an effort to find truth. The experiment failed, and her mother and father left the commune and moved to Florida, where her father got a job working on boats. Penny has painful memories of her mother slipping into delusion. First believing John Kennedy was her lover, then claiming she was being hunted by the FBI. Her mother was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic when Penny was a child. Today, Penny's mother lives on the streets of Seattle, where she adamantly refuses help from anyone, including Penny. Penny once told me that no matter how gingerly she put the puzzle of her past together, she was always cut by the sharp edges. The fact that her mother was stoned while giving birth, the enticing but deceptive delusions presented to her as a child, and the breakup not only of her mother from her father, but her mother from all reality. When I talk to Penny about driving up to Seattle to meet her mother, she tells me that I wouldn't enjoy the experience, that her mother will hate me. She hates everybody, Don. She thinks people are out to get her. If I call her on the phone in the shelter, she will come to the phone and hang it up. She doesn't answer my letters. She probably doesn't even open them. But she was normal at one time, right? I once asked. Yes. She was beautiful and fun. I loved my mom, Don, and I still do. But I hate that her mind has been taken. I hate that I can't have normal interaction with her. When Penny was 11, her parents divorced, and after the breakup, she moved west with her father, spending a year sailing around the Pacific on her father's sailboat before eventually settling in a tiny mountain town in eastern Washington. During those first 3 weeks in France, it was comforting for Penny that Nadine cared so much about her past and her story. This helped Penny listen to Nadine's story, and one night while walking on a beach in the south of France, Nadine explained to Penny why she was a Christian. She said that she believed Christ was a revolutionary, a humanitarian of sorts, sent from God to a world that had broken itself. Penny was frustrated that Nadine was a Christian. She couldn't believe that a girl this kind and accepting could subscribe to the same religion that generated the Crusades, funded the Republicans, or fathered religious television. But over the year at Sarah Lawrence, Nadine's flavor of Christianity became increasingly intriguing to Penny. Penny began to wonder if Christianity, were it a person, might in fact like her. She began to wonder if she and Christianity might get along, if they might have things in common. The first time Penny told me the story of how she became a Christian, we were walking through Laurelhurst Park, the beautiful park down the street from my house where lesbians go to walk their dogs. Nadine and I would sit for hours in her room, she began. Mostly we would talk about boys or school, but always, by the end of it, we talked about God. The thing I loved about Nadine was that I never felt like she was selling anything. She would talk about God as if she knew him, as if she had talked to him on the phone that day. She was never ashamed, which is the thing with some Christians I had encountered. They felt like they had to sell God as if he were soap or a vacuum cleaner, and it's like they really weren't listening to me. They didn't care. They just wanted me to buy their product. I came to realize that I had judged all Christians on the personalities of a few. That was frightening for me, too, because it had been so easy just to dismiss Christians as nuts, but here was Nadine. I didn't have a category for her. To Nadine, God was a being with which she interacted, and even more, Don, Nadine believed that God liked her. I thought that was beautiful. And more than that, her faith was a spiritual thing that produced a humanitarianism that was convicting. I was really freaked out because I wanted to be good, but I wasn't good. I was selfish, and Nadine, well, she was pretty good. I mean, she wasn't selfish. So she asked me if I wanted to read through the book of Matthew with her. And in fact, I did. I wanted to see if this whole Jesus thing was real. I still had serious issues with Jesus, though, only because I associated him with Christianity, and there was no way I would ever call myself a Christian. But I figured I should see for myself. So I told her yes.
"So then you started reading the Bible?" I asked.
"Yes."
We would eat chocolates and smoke cigarettes and read the Bible, which is the only way to do it, if you ask me.
Don, the Bible is so good with chocolate. I always thought the Bible was more of a salad thing, you know, but it isn't. It is a chocolate thing.
We started reading through Matthew, and I thought it was all very interesting, you know. And I found Jesus very disturbing, very straightforward. He wasn't diplomatic, and yet I felt like if I met him, he would really like me.
Don, I can't explain how freeing that was, to realize that if I met Jesus, he would like me. I never felt like that about some of the Christians on the radio. I always thought if I met those people, they would yell at me. But it wasn't like that with Jesus. There were people he loved and people he got really mad at, and I kept identifying with the people he loved, which was really good because they were all the broken people, you know, the kind of people who were tired of life and want to be done with it, or they're desperate people, people who were outcasts or pagans. There were others, regular people, but he didn't play favorites at all, which is miraculous in itself. That fact alone may have been the most supernatural thing he did. He didn't show partiality, which every human does.
I never thought of it that way, I told her.
He didn't show partiality at all, Don, and neither should we.
But listen, this is the best part. We got to the part of the book where Jesus started talking about soil.
Soil? Yeah. There is a part in Matthew where Jesus talks about soil, and he is going to throw some seed on the soil, and some of the seed is going to grow because the soil is good. And some of the seed isn't because it fell on rock or the soil that wasn't as good. And when I heard that, Don, everything in me leaped up and I wanted so bad to be the good soil. That is all I wanted, to be the good soil. I was like, Jesus, please let me be the good soil.
So that is when you became a Christian?
No, that was later.
So what happened next? I asked.
Well, later that month, it was in December, there was a raging party going on downstairs in the dorm, and I was pretty drunk and high, you know, and I wasn't feeling too well, so I started up the stairs to see if my friend Naomi was in her room, and she wasn't. So I went down to my room and sort of crashed on the floor. I just sort of lay there for a little while, and then it happened. Now, you have to promise to believe me.
Promise what?
Penny stopped walking and put her hands in her coat pockets. Okay. But I'm not crazy. She took a deep breath. I heard God speak to me.
Speak to you? I questioned.
Yes.
What did he say?
He said, Penny, I have a better life for you. Not only now, but forever.
When Penny said this, she put her hand over her mouth, as if that would stop her from crying.
Really? I said.
God said that to you?
Yes.
Penny talked through her hand.
Do you believe me?
I guess.
It doesn't matter whether you believe me or not.
Penny started walking again. That is what happened, Don. It was crazy. God said it. I got really freaked out about it, you know? I thought maybe it was the drugs, but I knew at the same time it wasn't the drugs. Penny put her hand on her forehead and smiled, shaking her head. I should read you my journal from that night. It was like, oh my God, God talked to me. I am having this trippy God thing right now. God is talking to me. I kept asking him to say it again, but he wouldn't. I guess it's because I heard him the first time, you know. Yeah, probably. So is that when you became a Christian? The night God talked to you? No. You didn't become a Christian, even after God talked to you? No. Why? I was drunk and high, Don. You should be sober when you make important decisions. That's a good point, I agreed. But I still thought she was crazy. So what happened next? Well, Penny started. A couple of nights later, I got on my knees and said I didn't want to be like this anymore. I wanted to be good, you know? I wanted God to help me care about other people because that's all I wanted to do, but I wasn't any good at it. I had already come to believe that Jesus was who he said he was, that Jesus was God. I don't know how I came to that conclusion. It wasn't like doing math. It was something entirely different, but I knew it. I knew inside that he was God. But this time I just prayed and asked God to forgive me. And that is when I became a Christian. It was pretty simple. Penny put her hands back in her pockets and looked at me with her gorgeous blue eyes. There, she said. Are you happy? And with that last comment, she stuck her tongue out and laughed. Tell me the story again, Penny. Start with arriving in France. Why? Because it's a good story. Tell it again, I told her. No. Once is enough. You'll probably put it in one of your Christian books or something. Never, I said adamantly. Chapter 5. Faith. Penguin sex. The goofy thing about Christian faith is that you believe it and don't believe it at the same time. It isn't unlike having an imaginary friend. I believe in Jesus. I believe he is the Son of God, but every time I sit down to explain this to somebody, I feel like a palm reader, like somebody who works at a circus, or a kid who's always making things up, or somebody at a Star Trek convention who hasn't figured out the show isn't real. Until. When one of my friends becomes a Christian, which happens about every 10 years because I am such a sheep about sharing my faith, the experience is euphoric. I see in their eyes the trueness of the story. Everybody at Reed was telling me something was wrong with Laura. They said she was depressed or something. I ran into her at a lecture in Vollum Lounge, which is beautiful like a museum with its tall white walls. Laura sat in front of me, and when the lecture was over, she didn't leave. Neither did I. I didn't want to bother her, but I could tell she was sad about something. How are you? I asked. I am not good. She turned to face me. I could see in her eyes she had spent the morning crying. What's wrong?
Everything.
Boy stuff? I asked.
No.
School stuff? I asked.
No.
God stuff? Laura just looked at me. Her eyes were sore and moist.
I guess so, Don. I don't know.
Can you explain any of it? The way you feel?
I feel like my life is a mess. I can't explain it. It's just a mess.
I see, I said.
Don, I just want to confess. I have done terrible things. Can I confess to you?
I don't think confessing to me is going to do you any good. As I said it, Laura wiped her eyes with her fingers.
I feel like he is after me, Don.
Who is after you? I asked.
God. I think that is very beautiful, Laura. And I believe you. I believe God wants you. I feel like he is after me, she repeated. What do you think he wants?
I don't know. I can't do this, Don. You don't understand. I can't do this.
Can't do what, Laura?
Be a Christian.
Why can't you be a Christian?
Laura didn't say anything.
She just looked at me and rolled her tired eyes. She dropped her hands into her lap with a sigh.
I wish I could read you my journal, she said, looking blankly at the wall. There's this part of me that wants to believe. I wrote about it in my journal. My family believes, Don. I feel as though I need to believe, like I am going to die if I don't believe. But it is all so stupid, so completely stupid.
Laura, why is it that you hang out with the Christians on campus?
I don't know. I guess I'm just curious.
She wiped her eye again.
You're not dumb, I don't think. I just don't understand how you can believe this stuff.
I don't either, really, I told her. But I believe in God, Laura. There is something inside me that causes me to believe. And now I believe God is after you, that God wants you to believe too.
What do you mean?
She asked, dropping her hands in her lap and sighing once again. I mean the idea that you want to confess. I think that God is wanting a relationship with you, and that starts by confessing directly to him. He is offering forgiveness.
You are not making this easy, Don.
I don't exactly believe I need a God to forgive me of anything.
I know.
But that's what I believe is happening. Perhaps you can see it as an act of social justice. The entire world is falling apart because nobody will admit they are wrong. But by asking God to forgive you, you are willing to own your own crap.
Laura sat silent for a while. She sort of mumbled under her breath. I can't, Don. It isn't a decision. It isn't something you decide.
What do you mean?
I can't get there. I can't just say it without meaning it.
She was getting very frustrated.
I can't do it. It would be like, say, trying to fall in love with somebody or trying to convince yourself that your favorite food is pancakes. You don't decide those things. They just happen to you. If God is real, he needs to happen to me.
That is true. But don't panic. It's okay. God brought you this far, Laura. He will bring you the rest of the way. It may take time.
But this hurts, she said. I want to believe, but I can't. I hate this.
Laura went back to her room. The next day, I got an email from Penny saying she, too, had talked with Laura. Penny asked me to pray for her as Laura felt trapped. Penny said she was going to spend a great deal of time with her, really walking through her emotions. I had no explanation for Laura. I don't think there is an explanation. My belief in Jesus did not seem rational or scientific, and yet there was nothing I could do to separate myself from this belief. I think Laura was looking for something rational because she believed that all things that were true were rational. But that isn't the case. Love, for example, is a true emotion, but it is not rational. What I mean is, people actually feel it. I have been in love. Plenty of people have been in love, yet love cannot be proved scientifically. Neither can beauty. Light cannot be proved scientifically, and yet we all believe in light and by light see all things. There are plenty of things that are true that don't make any sense. I think one of the problems Laura was having was that she wanted God to make sense. He doesn't. He will make no more sense to me
then I will make sense to an aunt. Tony and I were talking about Laura at the Horse Brass the other day. We were talking about belief, what it takes to believe, and he asked me how I believed in God. I felt silly trying to explain it, even though Tony is a Christian. I felt as if I were saying I believed in Peter Pan or the Tooth Fairy, and yet I don't believe in Peter Pan or the Tooth Fairy. I believe in God, and as I said before, it feels so much more like something is causing me to believe than that I am stirring up belief. In fact, I would even say that when I started in faith, I didn't want to believe. My intellect wanted to disbelieve, but my soul, that deeper instinct, could no more stop believing in God than Tony could on a dime stop being in love with his wife. There are things you choose to believe and beliefs that choose you. This was one of the ones that chose me. You know what really helped me understand why I believe in Jesus, Tony? What's that? Penguins, I told him. Penguins. Penguins, I clarified. Do you know very much about penguins? Nope. Tony smiled. Tell me about penguins. I watched a nature show on OPB the other night about penguins. They travel in enormous groups, perhaps 500 of them, and they swim north in the coldest of winter, so far north they hit ice. They look like cartoons, like something out of that movie Fantasia. All 500 of them swim till they hit ice, then they jump out of the water one by one and start sliding on their bellies. They sort of create ruts as they slide, and they follow each other in a line. They do this for days, I think. They slide on their bellies for days? Tony asked. Days, I told him. Why? I don't know, I confessed. But after a while, they stop sliding, and they get around in a big circle and start making noises. And what they are doing is looking for a mate. It's crazy. It's like a penguin nightclub or something, like a disco. They waddle around on the dance floor till they find a mate. Then what? Tony asked, sort of laughing. Penguin sex, I said. Penguin sex? Yes, penguin sex, right there on television. I felt like I was watching animal porn. What was it like? He asked. Less than exciting, I told him. Sort of a letdown. So, what does penguins having sex have to do with belief in God? Tony asked. Well, I'm getting to that. But let me tell you what else they do. First, the females lay eggs. They do that standing up. The eggs fall down between their legs, which are about an inch or something long, and the females rest the eggs on their feet. Then the males go over to the females, and the females give the males the eggs. Then, and this is the cool part, the females leave. They travel for days back to the ocean and jump in and go fishing. The females just take off and leave the men with the eggs? Tony asked. Yes. The males take care of the eggs. They sit on them. They have this little pocket between their legs where the egg goes. They gather around in an enormous circle to keep each other warm. The penguins on the inside of the circle very slowly move to the outside and then back to the inside. They do this to take turns on the outside of the circle because it is really cold. They do this for an entire month.
A month?
Yes. The males sit out there on the eggs for a month. They don't even eat. They just watch the eggs. Then the females come back, and right when they do, almost to the day, the eggs are hatched. The females somehow know, even though they have never had babies before, the exact day to go back to the males. And that is how baby penguins are made.
Very interesting. Tony clapped for me. So what is the analogy here?
I don't know, really. It's just that I identified with them. I know it sounds crazy, but as I watched, I felt like I was one of those penguins.
They have this radar inside them that told them when and where to go, and none of it made any sense. But they show up on the very day their babies are being born, and the radar always turns out to be right. I have a radar inside me that says to believe in Jesus. Somehow, penguin radar leads them perfectly well. Maybe it isn't so foolish that I follow the radar that is inside of me.
Tony smiled at my answer. He lifted his glass of beer. Here's to penguins, he said. In his book, Orthodoxy, G.K. Chesterton says chess players go crazy, not poets. I think he is right. You'd go crazy trying to explain penguins. It's best just to watch them and be entertained. I don't think you can explain how Christian faith works either. It is a mystery. And I love this about Christian spirituality. It cannot be explained, and yet it is beautiful and true. It is something you feel, and it comes from the soul. I crawled out of bed a few days later and cracked open the Bible on my desk. I didn't feel like reading, honestly, so I turned on my computer and fidgeted with a SimCity town I'd been working on. I checked my email and noticed one from Laura. She had sent it in the early hours of the morning. The subject read, "So anyway, about all of that stuff." Dearest friend Don, I read through the book of Matthew this evening. I was up all night. I couldn't stop reading, so I read through Mark. This Jesus of yours is either a madman or the Son of God. Somewhere in the middle of Mark, I realized he was the Son of God. I suppose this makes me a Christian. I feel much better now. Come to campus tonight, and let's get coffee. Much love, Laura.
Chapter 6. Redemption. The Sexy Carrots.
Long before I landed in Portland, but shortly after my own conversion to Christian spirituality, I experienced periods of affinity with God. I would lie on my bedroom floor reading my Bible, going at the words for hours, all of them strong like arms wrapped tightly around my chest. It seemed as though the words were alive with minds and motions of their own, as though God were crawling thoughts inside my head for guidance, comfort, and strength. For a while, I felt as though the world were a watch, and God had lifted the lid so I could see the gears. The intricate rules of the socio-spiritual landscape were something like a play to me, and I was delighted at every turn in the plot. The truths of the Bible were magic, like messages from heaven, like codes, enchanting codes that offered power over life, a sort of power that turned sorrow to joy, hardship to challenge, and trial to opportunity. Nothing in my life was mundane. After I became a Christian, every aspect of human interaction had a fascinating appeal, and the intricate complexity of the natural landscape was remarkable in its perfection. The colors in the sky melding with the horizon, those South Texas sunsets burning distant clouds like flares, like fireworks, like angel wings starting flight. God was no longer a slot machine, but something of a spirit that had the power to move men's souls. I seemed to have been provided answers to questions I had yet to ask, questions that God sensed or had even instilled in the lower reaches of my soul. The experience of becoming a Christian was delightful. I don't think, however, there are many people who can stay happy for long periods of time. Joy is a temporal thing. Its brief capacity, as reference, gives it its pleasure. And so some of the magic I was feeling began to fade. It's like a man who gets a new saw for Christmas, on the first morning feeling its weight and wondering at its power, hardly thinking of it as a tool from which he will produce years of labor. Early on, I made the mistake of wanting spiritual feelings to endure and remain romantic. Like a new couple expecting to always feel in love, I operated my faith thinking God and I were going to walk around smelling flowers.
When this didn't happen, I became confused. What was more frustrating than the loss of exhilaration was the return of my struggles with sin. I had become a Christian, so why did I still struggle with lust, greed, and envy? Why did I want to get drunk at parties or cheat on tests? My best friends in high school were Dean Birkbeil and Jason Holmes. Dean and Jason were both on the tennis team, and I was good enough as a practice partner, so we spent the majority of our hot Houston nights pounding the courts at the city park. We'd show up early in the afternoon and play till 10 or 11 when the city shut down the lights. Then we'd sit in the parking lot and drink beer, and Jason would smoke pot. Dean's dad was a recovering alcoholic who had been sober for something like 7 years. He was a handsome man, short, but he talked with a tongue swagger the way John Wayne talked in True Grit. Mr. Birkbeil had amazing stories of his drinking days. He told us that he was driving drunk one night and blacked out at the wheel, steering his car directly into a parked police cruiser. I always looked up to Dean's dad, what with his drinking stories and tattoos and that sort of thing. He worked in a hospital now and drove a black Volvo. My family had a Buick. My mother never drove drunk. My father probably did, but I hadn't seen him in years. When Dean and Jason and I would sit around in the parking lot, I felt earthy and real, like a guy out of a movie. They both came from wealthy families whose lives didn't revolve around church. I felt cool when I was with them, very sophisticated, as if I were going to play at Wimbledon the next week, sipping wine and signing autographs after the match. Dean and I were serving as co-presidents of the church youth group at the time. Dean never took any of it seriously. He took being president seriously, but not the stuff about spirituality, not the stuff about metaphysical things taking place in your life. I'd try to get him to go to church camp, but he never wanted to. Camp was at the end of the summer, and it was too close to the school year, and if he went to camp, he'd feel convicted, and it would take him a good 2 months to start drinking again, so he never went. One time, right after I got back from camp, Dean bought 2 cases of beer and had me stay over at his house. He said I had to get drunk to get over the initial guilt so I could have a good time at all the fall parties. I drank about a case all by myself. Dean and I walked over to the city park and shot baskets under the moon, staggering and swearing because we could never hit the rim. I didn't mind the drinking, mostly. Dean was about the best friend a guy could have. He really cared about people, I think, and so did Jason, for that matter. They just liked to have a good time, like anybody. With me, though, it was different. I really wanted to please God. I mean, I sort of wanted to please God. I felt like God had done something personal and real in my life. I also felt that I should probably try staying sober for a while, being co-president of the youth group and all. One night, while hanging out by the tennis courts, Jason pulled out a pretty good-sized bag of weed. Dean hardly smoked the stuff. He hated the taste and said it never got him high. I had never tried it, but that night Jason was pretty insistent on all of us giving it a go. I wasn't big on the idea. I had already had about 5 beers and was feeling pretty drunk. I had heard you shouldn't mix those things. Dean started packing Jason's pipe, and Jason got pretty excited, so I told him I'd take a hit. To be honest, it didn't do anything for me. Anything good. Like I said, I was already pretty drunk, and the pot just put me over the edge. I got sick about 5 minutes into it. I felt like I was stuck in a suitcase at the bottom of a ship in the middle of a storm. Everything started sloshing around in my stomach. My hands and forehead began to sweat, and my knees felt weak and yellow. I was paltry. We walked back to Dean's house, and I lay down in his dog-smelling backyard. I slipped into seasick dreams of alligators and TBN talk show hosts. Jason came out and lay next to me and went on and on about what truth was, and did I think there was anybody out there? Jason had come to believe that truth was something imparted to you when you were high. Later, he would go off to college. Friends of mine told me that he became known for waking up miles from campus in his underwear, never knowing how he got there. On this night, he was telling me about truth, about how it is something you know, but you don't know you are knowing it. He was saying the key to the meaning of life is probably on other planets.
Don. Don. He tried to get my attention. What, man?
I lay there, seasick.
They could live on